I want to thank you for coming. There's a tremendous amount of information to be shared tonight, and we're going to try and keep it moving along. So,
sure. Thank you, Mia. Again, welcome everyone. We're going to go ahead and get started. I just wanted to say thank you for coming on out. On behalf of the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives, we are helping to co-sponsor this event. It is our goal to be able to have folks from all the countries that are represented on campus, over 130 different countries represented here on campus, come together to be able to engage in educational opportunities, to engage with one another, to learn from one another, to experience, or maybe just a second, another person's perspective from their shoes, if you will. So this is the second annual Cesar E. Chavez Commemorative Celebration. We are happy that this is finally in place. There has been a celebration on campus in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King now for 32 years, as it should be. And now we are happy to add to the portfolio Cesar E. Chavez into the likes of folks that are American heroes, that are involved in the struggle for human rights, civil rights, have been, and now we are talking about continuing that struggle. So thank you so much. Diana, I'm going to turn it back over to you and we can get started.
Okay.
Okay, just a couple of things. And as some of you already know, this is the 50th anniversary, actually in 2 days, 50th anniversary of the UFW, when Cesar Chavez set up the UFW along with Dolores Huerta and hundreds of farm workers, Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, Filipinos, and others. And I think that to have a long-standing union that has made these efforts on behalf of not just labor, but the impact that it has had on civil rights and civil right movements and in this country and literally abroad, I think it is a testament to the work that the farm workers, that Chavez, that Huerta, and their supporters did. Many of you may know also that Cesar Chavez was a frequent visitor to Michigan, Lansing in particular. And it is that tie to Chavez and his work that I think keeps our efforts alive in commemorating this very humble man who was very strong in his beliefs. And that type of dedication deserves that commemoration. The book ban, in particular, I thought was very appropriate because it happened in Cesar Chavez's home state of Arizona. And it's baffling, really, how can a state that has such an American icon, or maybe it is because he is a Mexican-American icon, that this anti-civil rights, anti-immigrant, anti-freedom of speech activity is happening. The American Library Association, at their ALA midwinter meeting recently, came up with a resolution to oppose the restriction of materials and asked for an open inquiry in Arizona ethnic and cultural studies programs. You know, that type of commitment with librarianship has been longstanding, and I'm proud to be part of that profession that promotes intellectual freedom, that supports intellectual freedom, and that allows, freedom of expression. The books that were banned are items that you will be hearing about tonight. We're hearing from tonight. We have readers that will be reading both materials that were banned, actually, and authors that were banned. We will have the readers read first, respond to the readings, and then we will be taking questions and answers later after the readings, which will be short. We will be having Professor Dorinda Carter Andrews reading. She's from the College of Education. Her background is critical race theory in education. Welcome. Thank you very much. Professor Diego Rivera, who's from the College of Music, who will be reading from Teatro Campesino, something that is in his background, and addressing academic freedom as well. Professor Contreras will be reading as well. She's the director of Chicano Latino Studies. She is someone who has been active in Chicano studies for a long time academically and professionally. It'll be a two-tiered thing. She's doing a video and as well as a reading. Ignacio Andrade, who you also met, and Yolanda Brooks. Yolanda is a PhD student in the sciences. She will be, well, her background actually is a Peace Corps volunteer, a returned Peace Corps volunteer person who is from the Saginaw area and has for years, as even as a child, been involved in social issues. So with that, I'm going to ask for the video to begin, and Professor Contreras.
Okay, I'll just give you guys a little background about the video. This was part of an initiative that began in Houston. They were playing Libro Traficante, sort of play on narco trafficking, of course. And I'm just going to let Tony Diaz, the guy in the video, sort of explain it to you, and talk about it for a couple minutes.
My name's Tony. You might have heard that Arizona had the audacity to ban Latino studies. Well, I'm here to introduce a few new words into the lexicon of Arizona, courtesy of the Protester's Handbook, written right here in Houston, Texas. First phrase, Libro Traficante. Me and my fellow Libro Traficantes will be smuggling contraband books back into Arizona this spring break, March 2012. If you want to get involved, visit the website, LibroTraficante.com. Second phrase, wet book. These are books that we smuggle illegally across the border to be used in underground classes where we will conduct Latino literary studies. It's a lethal dose of Dagoberto Gil coming at you, Arizona. Third phrase, dime book. These are paperbacks that used to be worth only $10, but are now invaluable thanks to your fascist laws, Arizona. House on Mango Street, 25th Anniversary Edition by Sandra Cisneros. I heard she's leaving San Antonio. Maybe we can convince her to come live in Arizona. Contraband people. Arizona, we're throwing the book at you. V for victory, vatos.
But I think what's interesting, you know, part of what's interesting is the way in which, you know, the makers of this video, perhaps Tony Diaz, is sort of playing with the markers of an urban Chicano masculinity, sort of, you know, taking what is typically perceived to be negative and deploying it in the service of something else, of intellectual activity, of promoting books. The other things, you know, sort of drawing that association between contraband books, contraband bodies, which I think also draws attention to the illogic of book banning. Some people would say technically that it wasn't a ban, that the books were simply, they were confiscated, removed, that the titles themselves. But the fact of the matter is the classes were ended and the books were packed up and taken, which is in effect, you know, to many people, a ban of sorts. So that's what I like about it, sort of taking these stereotypic images to a degree and then turning them into something else. And that the, as I said, the association between
contraband books and contraband bodies, which then points to the sort of ridiculousness of also not allowing people, bodies, to cross borders freely. I think it makes that association. I also like that Tony Diaz focuses on Latino literary studies. For myself, you know, a student and a scholar of literature, literature plays such an important role in, well, in the development of Chicano studies and Latino studies more generally. I think has a real central place. So I don't want to say too much else because I just like to read some literature. Oh, I do want to make one more point, and that is that, I mean, we can look at what's happened in Arizona as the beginning of a ban on, you know, Latino books, on Mexican-American studies, which here we call Chicano studies. But from my perspective, our literature has been banned for a long, long time. You know, I've been teaching Latino lit at this campus since 1998. And not much has changed in terms of the exposure I see students coming into my classes with. And this includes a lot of future educators. This includes a lot of future educators who know very little about Latino literature, about Latino culture, but do know that they are going to have to be looking after Latino students in the very near future. They're really searching, they're seeking, and, you know, it's troubling. It's troubling to see after all this time that we're still in the same place. We're in a class of 45 students in Latino literature, and I ask how many people have read something written by a Latino, and very few people can raise their hand. And when they do, it's the obligatory House on Mungo Street or How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents. You know, typically the same titles coming up over and over again. But what I think is really tragic is that most of the Latino students in the class haven't read anything. And that, to me, is like the greater crime and the, just really sad. But so I have a couple things I'm going to read. Diana told me I only had 10 minutes. I want to begin with something by, oh, I lost all my bookmarks. I'm so sorry. Since I'm here, I'm going to begin with the one that I just lost. Sorry. I'm sorry, Diana. I had it all organized so well. And now I'm nervous, and so I can't find anything. Give me a second. Okay, here's what I'm going to read. I read this before very recently, but I think it's a poem that's worth repeating over and over and over again. And this is by Lorna de Cervantes, one of my favorite poets. I was just saying in class today. It's called Poem for the Young White Man Who Asked Me How I, an Intelligent, Well-Read Person, Could Believe in the War Between Races. In my land, there are no distinctions. The barbed wire politics of oppression have been torn down long ago. The only reminder of past battles lost or won is a slight rutting in the fertile fields. In my land, people write poems about love, full of nothing but contented, childlike syllables. Everyone reads Russian short stories and weeps. There are no boundaries. There is no hunger, no complicated famine or greed. I'm not a revolutionary. I don't even like political poems. Do you think I can believe in a war between races? I can deny it. I can forget about it when I'm safe, living on my own continent of harmony and home. But I am not there. I believe in revolution because everywhere the crosses are burning, sharp shooting goose-steppers around every corner, there are snipers in the schools. I know you don't believe this. You think this is nothing but faddish exaggeration, but they are not shooting at you. I'm marked by the color of my skin. The bullets are discreet and designed to kill slowly. They are aiming at my children. These are facts. Let me show you my wounds, my stumbling mind, my excuse me tongue, and the snagging preoccupation with the feeling of not being good enough. These bullets bury deeper than logic. Racism is non-intellectual. I cannot reason these scars away. Outside my door, there is a real enemy who hates me. I'm a poet who yearns to dance on rooftops, to whisper delicate lines about joy and the blessings of human understanding. I try, I go to my land, my tower of words, and bolt the door, but the typewriter doesn't fade out the sounds of blasting and muffled outrage. My own days bring me slaps on the face. Every day I am deluged with reminders that this is not my land and this is my land. I do not believe in the war between races, but in this country, there is war. So I have a couple more. You know, I think this is a real opportunity for us to, here's one I want to read, for us to get a little bit of exposure to Latino literature, to maybe step outside of our comfort zone. I do, you know, in going over the list today before I came here, there are a lot of texts that are not written by Latinos on that ban list. But I just want to be clear about something. They're there because they're associated with Mexican-American studies. They're there because of their relationship to Chicano studies, and that's why they're banned. So the real target is not Paulo Freire. The real target is not bell hooks. The real target is Chicanos, Mexican-Americans. I'm going to read this one. It's real short, and then I have one more. This is called The Toltec by Ana Castillo, circa 1955. My father was a Toltec. Everyone knows he was bad. Kicked the Irish boys from Bridgeport's ass, once went down to South Chicago to stick someone, got chased to the hood, running through the gangway, swish a blade in his back, the emblem jacket split in half. Next morning, mommy threw it away. So, and then I'm going to read this last one, also another one of my favorite poets, Teresa Palomo Acosta. This is a very widely anthologized poem. I think it's taught a lot in children's lit. I see it appearing in a lot of places. And it's called My Mother Peace Quilts. I don't know this one as well, so I might stumble a little bit. My Mother Peace Quilts. They were just meant as covers in winters, as weapons against pounding January winds. But it was just that every morning I awoke to these October-ripened canvases, passed my hand across their cloth faces, and began to wonder how you pieced all these together. These strips of gentle communion cotton and flannel nightgowns, wedding organdies, dime store velvets, how you shape patterns square and oblong and round, positioned, balanced, then cemented them with your thread, a steel needle, a thimble. How the thread darted in and out, galloping along the frayed edges, tucking them in as you did us at night. Oh, how you stretched and turned and rearranged your Michigan spring-faded curtain pieces, my father's Santa Fe work shirt, the summer denims, the tweeds of fall. In the evening, you sat at your canvas, our cracked linoleum floor, the drawing board, me lounging on your arm, and you staking out the plan, whether to put the lilac purple of Easter against the red plaid of winter going into spring, whether to mix a yellow with the blue and white and paint the Corpus Christi noon when my father held your hand, whether to shape a five-point star from the somber black silk you wore to grandmother's funeral. You were the river current carrying the roaring notes, forming them into pictures of a little boy reclining, a swallow flying. You were the caravan master at the reins, driving your threaded needle artillery across the mosaic cloth bridges, delivering yourself in separate testimonies. Oh, mother, you plunged me sobbing and laughing into our past, into the river crossing at 5, into the spinach fields, into the Plainview cotton rows, into tuberculosis wards, into braids and muslin dresses sewn hard and taut to withstand the thrashings of 25 years. Stretched out, they lay armed, ready, shouting, celebrating. Knotted with love, the quilts sing on. Thanks. Thanks, you guys.
Good evening. Get my place here. I'd like to discuss and talk a little bit about Los Vendidos, a play by Luis Valdés. Although this particular play wasn't on the banned book list, Luis Valdés is actually an author who is on the banned book list. I believe Zoot Suit and other plays was one that actually had the unfortunate of making it to this list. And this is a collection of plays, and it's a collection of messages, and it's using the arts, which is something that I personally, as a musician, as an artist, I have a big problem with. Actually taking away the arts, and I think that's actually the truest and one of the most genuine forms of free speech is communication through the arts. And I have an even bigger problem with it due to the fact that they're taking this out of the schools. You know, it's in a sense, it's suffocating the students' voice. It's really cutting them off. and it's not telling them, and it's not really giving them opportunities to express themselves. I think communication through the arts, be it theater, be it music, any opportunities that are taken away from students and from young people, I think is really a tragedy. So this, and I'll kind of explain my kind of personal connection to this one in a minute. This is Los Vendidos takes place in a fictitious shop and is owned by this character named Anis Sancho. And the name of the shop is Anis Sancho's Used Mexican Lot. And the plot is that the secretary comes in looking for a Mexican type, and it's a secretary from Governor Reagan's office. And the secretary introduces herself as Miss Jimenez. And Sancho replies, "Oh, Jimenez, una chicana." And she was like, "No, Jimenez. You know, do you not speak English?" And so, you know, they kind of like wrestle with this. And so one by one, Anis Sancho introduces these models, or they're actually, as we learn in the play, they're robots. They're robots that are presented to the secretary. And the first robot that she's introduced to is the farm worker. And I think this kind of represents what many would see as stereotypical, a good citizen, kind of non-threatening stereotype. And the thing that is really presented and the thing that's made attractive to the secretary is that the farm worker is hardworking, submissive, goes away at the end of the season, you know, really out of sight, out of mind kind of figure, and very economical. You know, it doesn't take much, and it's a real bargain. But of course, the drawbacks is that the farm worker doesn't speak English. So that doesn't work. Then we're introduced to the pachuco, right? The urban citizen, somebody who was in touch and assimilated to the streetwise ways of America in a certain sense. And the pros are that the person speaks English, albeit vulgar, but Anis Sancho is all too happy to point out, well, he learned to speak English in your schools. And one of the other things that that I find really interesting in this play is that what's actually attractive to the secretary is that the pachuco suffers from a serious inferiority complex, which is really interesting. And I think that's really made a point of in Luis's writing of this particular character. So what are the cons? What are the drawbacks? Is that the pachuco is seen as violent, into crime and into drugs. So again, not necessarily somebody that would be an ideal representative for Governor Reagan's office. Then we're introduced to the revolutionary. And what are the pros about the revolutionary to the secretary? Well, he's a romantic. You know, and I don't know if this is Reagan's kind of obsession with the Old West, but he's a cowboy. He's the perfect depiction of the Mexican or the revolutionary or the passionate person that we see in the movies, right? He's all dedicated to his cause, and he's very passionate about his cause, capable of starting revolutions, and he's a visionary. What's the one con? He's made in Mexico, not an American. So again, we run into these kind of deal breakers that Luis kind of like puts forward, but and again, it's through these stereotypes that he's presenting each one of these figures. Then finally, we come to the Mexican American, and with this one, it's all pros, made in America, English speaking, and really an assimilated brown face for Governor Reagan's office in the secretary's eyes. And this whole process kind of, she's sold on the Mexican-American, or the idea of the Mexican-American. When I had an opportunity to do this play, I did this play in high school for my high school class and for an assembly, a festival of cultures. And I think I changed a little bit of the characters' names. I think in place of the Mexican-American, I used Mr. Hispanic. And this is kind of like the assimilated version, or what is oftentimes looked at as an acceptable or a non-threatening Mexican American. And this all comes to a really critical point in the play, when what happens is the Mexican American actually starts showing signs of and showing traits of the other three robots, right? And really is just at times they blurred out these really like revolutionary and very subversive and very like radical phrases, and this frightens the secretary, and the secretary is forced to run away. And so this is the end of the play. So this is after the Mexican-American turns to the Pachuco and starts turning on these robots one by one. The Pachuco says, I'm going to get you, baby. Viva la raza. Turns to the farm worker. Viva la huelga. Viva la huelga. And turns to revolutionary. Viva la revolución. Right? And this scares the secretary away. She runs away. And I'll read you just the end of the play, which I think is one of the most important parts of it and really carries the message. The three models join together and advance towards the secretary, who backs up and runs out of the shop screaming. Sancho is at the other end of the shop, holding his money in his hand. All freeze. After a few seconds of silence, the Pachuco moves and stretches, shaking his arms and loosening up. The farm worker and the revolutionary do the same. Sancho stays where he is, frozen to his spot. The Pachuco says, man, that was a long one, ese. The others agree with him. The farm worker asks, so how do we do? And the Pachuco says, pretty good, pretty good. He goes over to Sancho and removes the money from his hand. Sancho stays where he is. The revolutionary says, en la madre, look at all that money. The Pachuco says, we keep this up, we're going to be rich. The farm worker says, they think that we're the machines. The revolutionary, they think we're burros. And the Pachuco says, they think we're puppets. The Mexican-American says, the only thing I don't like is how come I always got to play the damn American, a Mexican-American. And the Pachuco says to him, well, that's what you get for graduating high school. And the farm worker says, well, how about our wages? The Pachuco splits up the money. And he says, well, here it comes. 3,000 for you, 3,000 for you, 3,000 for you, 3,000 for me. And the rest we put back into the business. That's too much, man. Hey, where are you vatos going tonight? The farmer says, well, I'm going over to Concha's. There's a party. And the Pachuco says, wait a minute, vatos. What about our salesman? I think he needs an oil job. The revolutionary says, leave him to me. The Pachuco, the farm worker, and the Mexican-American exit, talking loudly about their plans for the night. The revolutionary goes over to Sancho, removes his derby hat, his cigar, lifts him up, and throws him over his shoulder. Sancho hangs loose and lifeless. The revolutionary then turns to the audience and says, he's the best model we got. So it turns out Sancho was actually the robot. And I think it's really important to what are some of the key points, one of the lessons, is that this play really exposes and puts right into the face some of the stereotypes of Chicanos in America. I think it's also interesting that the secretary's disapproval and the apprehension of all of these different models really exposes prejudice by not only white Americans, but also by the government. This is representative from Governor Reagan's office. And I think a key plot point and what I tried to kind of, or what I took away from it, anything, is that in the end, all four models pose a threat to the secretary, including the Mexican-American. And I think this is the one thing personally that I took away with it, is that we're all hardworking. We're all streetwise. We're all dedicated to a cause, and we're all sophisticated. So each one of the stereotypes had traits that, you know, I think embodies what it means to be Chicano. And the salesman who represents the stereotype is the real fake, as are the stereotypes. This is a play that I did at East Lansing High School the following morning, myself along with my brother and along with one friend, one of my friends, we were vilified in front of the entire student body. The principal came on the you know closed circuit TV and basically denounced the program. And you know, I thought it was a real turning point because at first I was, you know, well, how could they not get this? I thought we were so smart about this. And that's when I really came to the realization that what I think is important to teach our young people is that they will grow up in communities sometimes that confuse homogenization with diversity, and that they need to be able to be very savvy and be able to identify the difference between diversity and homogenization. so that they can learn one day to stand up and say, look, I'm different. I am different. I have a different set of social causes. I have a different set of social needs. And not be dissuaded by someone that says, no, we're all the same. You know? So there's that struggle. So this is a very interesting play, and I think it's a very important kind of examination of stereotypes and self realization and self identity. So, I guess in closing, I would say I hope more of his plays make it into the theaters in high schools. So, thank you.
So, good evening. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for asking me to come. I am going to be reading a little bit. Dr. Contreras mentioned Paulo Freire's work, and I am going to be reading from Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is one of the books on the BAM book list. And as Diana said earlier, I do teach a course called Critical Race Theory in Education. And I see Mel here, who has taken the course. And we study not only critical race theory, but many of the branches of critical race theory, Lat Crit, Tribal Crit, Asian Crit. Many of you may not know that there are a lot of kind of racially based critical theories that come out of the critical race theory movement, which came out of critical legal studies. And critical race theory really asks us to, assume that racism is endemic to U.S. society. And that if we know that, how do we live a life of raising up those voices that are historically, traditionally, and kind of systemically marginalized all the time, racially and ethnically? And how do we look at those intersections of oppression around race, class, gender, sexuality, etc.? And while Paulo Freire himself does not do a racial analysis in his work, I think a lot of what he theorizes around the oppressed and the oppressor can be directly applied to issues of race relations, racial ethnic relations, both in the black-white binary and beyond that. And so as we think about what's happening in Arizona, and thinking about really this culture of silencing, this culture of dehumanizing, and a way of racializing students' schooling experiences in ways that they don't even see happening. I think referring back to some of the theorizing of Paulo Freire is really important. One of the things, his work really drives my own pedagogical practices as an educator. And I draw a lot from him and bell hooks in terms of thinking about education as the practice of one's freedom. And as we think about what is happening in Arizona and really across our nation, to what degree are our young people being allowed to use their education as the practice of their freedom? They're really not. They're being imposed upon with a certain type of education, which really inherently is dehumanizing. And so I'm going to read a little bit from Pedagogy of the Oppressed, specifically Chapter 3, where Freire talks a lot about the role of dialogue in the humanization process. And I think that's really relevant for this time at hand right now. As we attempt to analyze dialogue as a human phenomenon, we discover something, which is the essence of dialogue itself, the word. But the word is more than just an instrument which makes dialogue possible. Accordingly, we must seek its constitutive elements. Within the word, we find two dimensions, reflection and action. In such radical interaction that if one is sacrificed, even in part, the other immediately suffers. There is no true word that is not at the same time a praxis. Thus, to speak a true word is to transform the world. An unauthentic word, one which is unable to transform reality, results when dichotomy is imposed upon its constitutive elements. When a word is deprived of its dimensions of action, reflection automatically suffers as well. And the word is changed into idle chatter, into verbalism, into an alienated and alienating blah. It becomes an empty word, one which cannot denounce the world, for denunciation is impossible without a commitment to transform, and there is no transformation without action. On the other hand, if action is emphasized exclusively to the detriment of reflection, the word is converted into activism. The latter, action for action's sake, negates the true praxis and makes dialogue impossible. Either dichotomy, by creating unauthentic forms of existence, creates also unauthentic forms of thought, which reinforce the original dichotomy. Human existence cannot be silent, nor can it be nourished by false words, but only by true words with which men and women transform the world. To exist humanly is to name the world, to change it. Once named, the world in its turn reappears to the namers as a problem and requires of them a new naming. Human beings are not built in silence, but in word, in work, in action, reflection. But while to say the true word, which is work, which is praxis, is to transform the world, saying that word is not the privilege of some few persons, but the right of everyone. Consequently, no one can say a true word alone, nor can she say it for another in a prescriptive act which robs others of their words. Dialogue is the encounter between men, mediated by the world in order to name the world. Hence, dialogue cannot occur between those who want to name the world and those who do not wish this naming, between those who deny others the right to speak their word and those whose right to speak has been denied of them. Those who have been denied their primordial right to speak their word must first reclaim this right and prevent the continuation of this dehumanizing aggression. I love that. If it is in speaking their word that people, by naming the world, transform it, dialogue imposes itself as the way by which they achieve significance as human beings. Dialogue is thus an existential necessity. And since dialogue is the encounter in which the united reflection and action of the dialoguers are addressed to the world, which is to be transformed and humanized, this dialogue cannot be reduced to the act of one person's depositing ideas in another, nor can it be a simple exchange of ideas to be consumed by discussants. Nor yet is it a hostile polemical argument between those who are committed neither to naming of the world nor to the search for truth, but rather to the imposition of their own truth. Because dialogue is an encounter among men and women who name the world, it must not be a situation where some name on behalf of others. It is an act of creation. It must not serve as a crafty instrument for the domination of one person by another. The domination implicit in dialogue is that of the world by the dialoguers. It is the conquest of the world for the liberation of humankind. Dialogue cannot exist, however, in the absence of a profound love for the world and for people. The naming of the world, which is an act of creation and recreation, is not possible if it is not infused with love. Love is at the same time the foundation of dialogue and dialogue itself. It is thus necessarily the task of responsible subjects and cannot exist in a relation of domination. Domination reveals the pathology of love, sadism in the dominator, and masochism in the dominated. Because love is an act of courage, not of fear, love is commitment to others. No matter where the oppressed are found, the act of love is commitment to their cause, the cause of liberation. And this commitment, because it is loving, is dialogical. And so I wanted to read that particular passage because I think it speaks to the role of dialogue in this process for our young people, for their own humanity, for their liberation. And as we see this kind of truth and knowledge being removed from their formal education, they lose that ability to name their own world and rather have an imposition of the world being named and defined on them. And so I just ask in the spirit of Paulo Freire and others whose work has been banned, in the words of Angela Valenzuela, our youth are experiencing a subtractive schooling as a result of this. It subtracts their full humanity. It subtracts their ability to name their worlds. And I just ask us to stay committed to the fight to re-embrace that and engage that for them. Thank you.
Good evening. So I will be reading just a little bit of one of the books called Codex Tamanchan. And it's On Becoming Human by Roberto Rodriguez. And this book mostly talks about humanity, and the introduction states that this book was a gift for healing. So it states in the introduction that it gives ancient messages from the codices of our ancestors into a language that is understandable today. So we'll see how, So I'll be reading a little bit on the chapter that talks about, that's entitled, Toward a Tongue-Tied Nation. Who would think that the beginning of a new millennium, the dawn of the celestial soul, to be precise, when we are pondering the beginning of a new world and the future of humanity, when we are struggling to understand our role in the universe, we would be having societal debates over languages. Or perhaps more precisely, who would have imagined that there would be a debate in the United States regarding the wisdom of knowing more than one language? Who would have thought that? Of course, a debate such as this could not be taking place anywhere else in the world other than the United States. Apparently, according to xenophobes, the path to becoming a good human being must be taken only by U.S. citizens and in English only. During 1998, I spoke at Winchell Elementary School in Fresno, California, at which time I thought of a question of bilingual education was settled, asking them whether it would be better to know one language or two languages. All the students replied, dos, two. They also promised that they would not become not only bilingual, but trilingual, regardless of whether Proposition 227 passed. To be sure, the passage of California's 1998 Proposition 227, the Anti-Bilingual Education Initiative, was bad news all the way around, save for people's determination to be trilingual. The worst aspects of the initiative was that it gave the anti-raza bigots around the country the signal that they can continue to impose their tyranny of the majority, and that local control of schools is no longer something that this country cherishes. Of course, the question the night the proposition passed was, what's the next anti-RASA proposition? But that was the wrong question to be asking. The question wasn't either about legal challenges. The pattern had already been set with the anti-immigration Proposition 187 and the anti-affirmative action 209. both went the legal route with 187 going down and 209 being affirmed. After these propositions and the legislation that has sought to accomplish the same goals nationally, it is obvious that all this has little to do with participatory democracy, or that has nothing to do with an angry electorate that is seeking to reform big government and an unresponsive government. Plain and simple, leave the Senate to mob rule. Even that does not adequately describe the mentality at hand. If we step back, we can actually see that this is something much bigger, with deeper roots than the current anti-immigration hysteria. What has been happening for the past few years relative to propositions and the subsequent federalization of them is what is being can be characterized as electoral genocide. Why lynch when the same can be accomplished by voters passing judgment on people who can't vote or populations with substantial less voters? It's the equivalent of what Newt Gingrich and company have done at the legislative level during the same period in question. What they have done in turn is turn their cannons against populations that don't have support of mainstream political parties or that are not awash with votes, power, or money. And to give a little bit. So it's been said before that the vicious anti-RASA and anti-immigration movements of this country of the 1990s has indeed resurrected Aslan. But unlike the 1960s, Aslan is not or should not be about the Southwest, but rather about a spiritual nation that is not tied to the land. The land is sacred, but it also does not belong to anyone. All Native and Indigenous spirituality teaches us this. Sometimes people view us as landless, but if no one owns the land, then we cannot be landless in this context. If no one owns it, then thus the idea of creating a sovereign spiritual nation does not need to be tied to the ownership of land. Besides, if we were to claim the Southwest, we would be encroaching on the ancestral lands of many other Indigenous people and Pueblos. That's separate from the fact that many of us have blood and spiritual relations to these same Pueblos and these same peoples. It's also separate from the belief and from the Mexican tradition that these indeed are also part of our ancestral lands. We don't need to claim land to be able to form a spiritual nation. If we are actually talking about geographical space, then maybe we would have to pay attention to the dictates of the United Nations, our governments, and whose territories we were disputing. However, neither the UN nor any nation state has anything to say about spiritual nations. Nor is it any of their business. If we choose to create a spiritual and sovereign nation, we need permission from no one. However, we do seek prayers and guidance from all elders, and from all spiritual leaders. So something to think about, as in, even though our schools might be failing our children, that we still have the space to make our own spiritual nation, to make our own space to find healing. So something to think about.
Good evening, everyone. I'm going to be reading from the works of Betita Martinez. De Colores means all of us. The title of this work is For Whom the Taco Bell Tolls. Favorite of some of you out there, I can tell, in one way or another. Forgive me, I'm not familiar with his work. I'm standing in, pinch hitting, if you will, for one of our very talented students who couldn't be here this evening, so bear with me. Listen up, all you Chicanos and Chicanas out there. Call yourself Hispanics if you like, but it will do no good when Taco Bell gets to you. Time to catch on, fellow Spics. This land is not our land. It belongs to the gringos and their border lights. We got the word loud and clear during the 1995 Super Bowl. Picture this, if you will, as a commercial you happen to watch while the Super Bowl is on break. It's night, a young man and woman in a pickup truck are looking for a quiet place to make out. They pull over in a dark, deserted spot and start doing their thing. Just then, a blinding searchlight hits them. All kinds of lights flash. Helicopters whir overhead. What is this shit? They are wondering. Then the message, border lights are coming. Border lights, as in lights. Where Taco Bell's new menu of supposedly nutritious, low-calorie Mexican food. For lots of us, cucarachas, that commercial was a creepy reminder of the truly Gacho Light Up the Border campaign in Southern California, where I'm from. Concocted by Muriel Watson, the widow of a Border Patrol officer, the campaign had Anglos park their cars at a site facing the border at night. They would turn on their headlights with the supposed goal of revealing illegals trying to sneak into Gringolandia. Sometimes up to 600 cars would do this. So border lights doesn't sound so good to many of us who have this weird idea that California used to be part of Mexico. In other words, we didn't cross the border crossed us. The Taco Bell commercial drew complaints from the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund that it was a subtle attack on Latinos and exacerbated anti-immigrant sentiment. The New York Times business section had its doubts about the ad. On January 31st, 1995, the advertising column carried a roundup on Super Bowl commercials, commenting that Taco Bell spots stirred unpleasant associations by juxtaposing the Taco Bell theme "Cross the Border" with helicopters ominously shining searchlights. Taco Bell itself just couldn't understand all the fuss. A company spokeswoman said the ad had no relation to the anti-immigrant furor. Tell that to the INS. The commercial was a creature of a $75 million advertising campaign for Border Lights food, such as the Border Light Taco Supreme, available at Taco Bell's 45,000 locations. I'm sorry, 4,500 locations. Seems like 45,000 sometimes. Especially when they combine it with Pizza Hut and KFC and the like, but sorry. We have also had the Run for the Border campaign, one version of which was immortalized in a Taco Bell paper mat placed on a serving tray. Pictured on the mat is a tiny Taco Bell restaurant seen from far away. A highway runs down the middle of the picture heading straight for the eatery. On both sides appear freeway-type signs bearing such phrases as "Jump It" and "Crash It." Taco Bell's parent company is Pepsi, which also has solid racist credentials. It owned Frito-Lay, creator of Frito Bandito, who advertised its chips back in the 1960s. Señor Frito was a gun-toting, wildly mustached, rotund little guy under a gigantic sombrero. His silly appearance together with his hands outspread in a helpless who-me gesture, assured Anglos he was no threat. Strong protests during the 1970s finally retired this particular version of a well-worn stereotype. Taco Bell has a reputation for racist advertising that reaches beyond raza. The company once put on a notorious commercial showing some scantily clad black folks in supposed tribal costume dancing around a fire going wild, the voice said, for a Taco Bell burrito. A culture reflects a society's anxiety, says painter Yolanda Lopez, who has made a revealing video. When you think of Mexico, commercial images of Mexicans in the mass media. As Yolanda commented, the Taco Bell border ads provide a safety valve in a time of fear. They soothe Anglos afraid of demographic change, afraid of losing the majority control. Such commercials play on this fear and then exploit it by telling you to experience the adventure of the border. Eat a 59-cent taco. Raza, today we face a ferocious, complex, divisive assault on immigrant rights along with affirmative action, bilingualism, and other hard-won gains. Sometimes the attack will be direct hatred and destructiveness. In other cases, the attack will be indirect. A racism that plays games with us and our food belittles us to the point of dehumanization and then says, it's just a joke. Don't be so serious. Both direct and indirect ideological warfare are real. Some remember, we don't need no border lights. So we remember, we don't need no border lights. A veggie burger with lots of green chili is more what raza needs, you know? So for me, this piece hits home in many ways, one of which is, as in your youth, you're growing and experiencing the world on your own around this age in 1995 when I was in high school, and you're just growing at a rate of experiences that for me in my life, there's very few other times that happened. The university is another one, but in 1995, I remember this commercial, and I remember even before that when the campaign, I'm glad it mentions it in here, make a run for the border. They make a catchy tune. I thought it was everywhere in the nation. Maybe I don't know if it played out here or not, but it definitely was in California, in Southern California. Make a run for the border. And this is something that if you have ever been to Southern California and driven the freeways down in Southern California, you may be familiar with some of the signs that they have along the freeways that show caution. Yeah, big yellow caution signs with a family crossing. Mom, a dad, and a young child crossing the freeway, running across the border illegally. So watch out. It's very dangerous. We're under siege. Be careful. You could be hurt by this. They could be hurt, but more importantly, you could be hurt. Have caution. So I remember seeing that growing up and hearing the campaign, make a run for the border, and it has a big impact. When I graduated from high school and was about to go into college, around that time frame, there was also the Proposition 187 that was alive and well campaign in California. And this, for folks out here in Michigan, will maybe know it as Proposition 2 over here. The gentleman who propagated that campaign in a large part was one of the UC regents, similar to the Board of Trustees, obviously, out over here, but for the entire University of California system. And he was successful in being able to have a campaign that pushed forward that legislation, which was ultimately repealed as unconstitutional. But never did I think that I would be in a situation that I now am forced to deal with that in a different perspective. But it's haunted me from my Southern California days. And I come to Michigan, finding out that is one of the most segregated of all of the 50 states. That was absolutely one of the most shocking things I have ever experienced as far as traveling within the United States. I thought for sure somewhere in the South, Mississippi, Alabama, but no, it was here in Michigan. So coming here and having that, coming to the point where we had Proposition 2, Ward Connerly and his gang came out this way and try to wreak havoc again here in Michigan and another state. Anybody who will listen, they're game to influence. And so to sum it up, these type of issues, this type of legislation, onslaught of these type of issues is relentless, not only in the most populated and most diverse states in the nation, but also in the most segregated state, if you will, in the nation. So no matter where you go, even if you're in Los Angeles County, where my wife is from, and I've spent many, many years there, even if you're there, you find it there. Don't let them fool you. It's here as well. It's there. What I'd like to finish with is what's most surprising to me is that when the campaign a year and a half ago, when Arizona SB 1070 was passed, and I thought, well, you know, that's happening in Arizona. Sometimes they do crazy stuff over there. Weren't they the same folks that didn't want to recognize MLK holiday, and they only did so because they were going to be reprimanded and not having, I think, the Super Bowl or something like that? They're crazy over there anyways, you know. But no, in reality now, when they did that, one of the first states to have a copycat law was Michigan. And I said, oh, my goodness. For me, it's very personal. For me, I can't help but lose words for explaining how I feel about the future. I have a son that's 3 years old, and having him be able to not be profiled, not be harassed, not be legally searched and pulled over. It's happened to me here in Michigan. I know for sure it's happened to me in California, and I know for sure what happened in Arizona. So what does that say? It says to me that there's a lot of work to be done, and whenever we can stand together to combat these type of oppressive and divisive politics and legislation efforts, we need to do so, especially when we have the security of having the diversity of a university community. That doesn't happen everywhere. It's not, you don't find the diversity, you know, in Michigan. I find it at the university, you find it, but not throughout Michigan. And so I'd like to end with that. I thank you very much for your time and coming on out. And I'll turn it over to the next, do we have the next, Diana Rivera? Thank you.
One of the things that we need to ask is, what's being banned really? You know, what is really being banned? The message has been sent out that the books constitute a divisive and separatist notion among Chicano and Mexican-American community from mainstream society. You know, it's books that have a voice that isn't available elsewhere. Okay. And as a librarian, I found it quite offensive that a dictionary would be banned. Now, I'm not naive enough or so naive to say that the content of dictionaries isn't political or isn't something that should be contested. However, when you're having a community write the history from a non-European perspective, you really need to ask, are we really being fed a line when we're being taught history, when we're being taught literature, and when we're being taught social policy and politics? And my answer is yes. When articles such as labor unions and Latino workers are seen as divisive, in the same book, the article right across is the Ku Klux Klan. Okay. Now, that the Latino perspective is given, and I'm not saying that it's not documented or verified with primary sources or historical sources, because they are. When something like this gets contested, again, the question is, what are they really banning? Who are they really banning? So before we start taking questions from the folks here, I just wanted to mention, again, the cookies that the Office of Inclusion brought, cookies and refreshments. But also, there are books back there that are on the banned book list that are not checked out that you're welcome to take with you and to check out downstairs at the circulation desk, as well as some books on Cesar Chavez and his work, the union and the 50 years that he's been working it. So before you leave, go ahead and take those. Now, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so first thing I did say was the book I read from, which is Infinite Divisions, the Anthology of Chicana Literature. But the other thing, and I actually meant to say this, and I thought of it afterwards, and Ignacio, when he was talking, made me
made me think of Trayvon Martin. And so I want to go back to Tony Díaz and what he's doing with sort of, like I said, these trappings of an urban masculinity, one that is criminalized, that is represented, you know, pretty much negatively, right? And we also heard in the Luis Valdez piece that Diego read the sort of that remark about the Mexican-American, oh, well, you graduated from high school, so you're not Chicano, you must be. So it's sort of a sort of dismissal or denigration or humiliation of those who you know, pursue education. So what happened to Trayvon Martin happened because the U.S. public cannot imagine a hoodie and a cell phone and a black man, a young black man, outside of something that is threatening to personal safety. Is an incredible lack of imagination. Do we have to say that, you know, our kids should not wear certain clothes, shouldn't wear a certain brand of jeans? I mean, I know in some places that is legislated, in schools, for example. Shouldn't wear hoodies, et cetera. No, I mean, and I think it goes back to what Professor Carter was saying earlier, and also what Mrs. Rivera was talking about, in terms of what is really being banned. What is being banned, what is being taken away, is the power to name ourselves. The power to name our reality, the power to name ourselves, the power to express ourselves in the ways that we choose without being interpolated in ways that name us only, you know, always, forever as threatening, as destructive, and as less than human, less than evolved. So I thought it was really important because, you know, Trayvon Martin's on all our minds. You know, I told my little girls driving in the car today, we went to school, I said, that could happen in Lansing. You know, I mean, I didn't want to scare them, but I want them to know this. This is a reality that we live with, and some of us from some communities more than others. But so I wanted, because it's all connected, right? Our struggles, Latino struggles, are connected to the struggles of African Americans, to the struggles of Native people, et cetera. So that was all. I just wanted to.
Okay, so is there questions that anyone has for the speakers, or the speakers for the speakers, or the speakers want to expound on their presentation? Mr. Lopez.
Thank you, Jenna. I wanted to bring to the attention of folks here that in Lansing, several years ago, Jose Rodriguez from Chicago was here in the Lansing School District. He was a Chicano who involved in drugs, and was a bad guy. Okay, but then he turned his life and started to work with Chicanitos and the Latino community to help them get out of that, you know, that life. Well, he wrote a book, and I think it was the Chicano Advisory Committee and the Latino clubs selected a book, and all of the Eastern High School was going to read it. It was going to be in the whole school. Well, there's some people that wanted to ban the book, because it was violent and they had swear words and stuff like that. So there was a big to-do, and at that point, years ago, I was an instructional counselor. And we had to have a meeting to review that. Say we would ban the book from the district. So I'd bring that to the attention to know that things happen here. Where's another? They happen here. And so we, even though it's not as, it wasn't as big as what we talked about, mm-hmm. Things do happen, and so it's not like new, but it is new in where it is what's going on.
Thank you, and I think the book is Luis J. Rodriguez, Mi Vida Loca, and that's correct, yes. I think that when Professor Contreras is saying, you know, that could happen in Lansing, the whole hoodie, the look, actually I think it did happen. I thought that was like Cipriano Torres. I may be wrong, but I kind of remember.
I don't know that he had a hoodie on, but he was shot 40 times
by the Lansing Police Department. So. Okay. Mr. Anguiano's class, do you have questions? No? Okay. Yes. The lady.
If I'm correct, I think the Rosa Studies ban was like
Raza Studies was for middle school and high school. That's correct.
I was wondering if you happen to know, like, the response from the students there, because I know they're younger, right? And I have sisters that are younger. I'm just curious if you have the response of what the students have done at age, you know, like 12, 13, or whatever. Maybe even it's more of their families. I'm just curious if you really.
Yeah. Well, some of the reactions from the students themselves have included walkouts. They have also been part of the Libro Traficante scene. They have spoken in front of the school board themselves. They have had rallies that they've been involved in. And, of course, they've had some support from university students and the parents and communities, but I think that you may find that the students themselves are quite actively involved in that.
Some of them were, I'm not sure if it was the middle school and high school, the middle school, but I think probably some high school students were arrested for occupying the, I can't remember, it was the Capitol, I think. So they're taking it. You know they're taking it.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. All the readings and an author that Professor Rivera here wrote, read from. But Luis Valdez's material is on that banned book list. And I think maybe one of the things that Diego here didn't quite go into a little bit or more into was, or maybe you did, I'm sorry if I missed it, but that the reaction from school personnel in East Lansing.
Students from the dominant group, you know, which I would call white, Euro-American, I mean, they, you know, and certainly not everybody, not, you know, I wouldn't want to say that way, but we do, and I think particularly women of color, we teach about race, and we teach about gender, we get hit hard on evaluations because people can understand that material in some ways only as racist because they're not at the center, and they're not used to that, right? They're not used to that. Where some of us, we've, you know, our whole education, we've been used to being on the margins. We've been used to looking and not seeing ourselves in the curriculum. It never even occurred to us to look for ourselves. It's a very different position than to be socialized into expecting always to see something that sort of looks like yourself there, even if it's not a one-to-one correspondence. So here, I mean, we see it, like I said, on evaluations. You know, I you know, get called racist. I shouldn't be teaching some feminists. You know, it doesn't. Believe me, I've been called worse things probably, but it does, I think, speak to a sort of resistance amongst citizens of the U.S. to citizens, Euro-American citizens of the U.S. as a group, not individually, because certainly I depend upon white anti-racist students in the classroom. depend on them to speak up and to be able to say things to their peers that I can't say, or the other people of color in the class, you know, just, you know, frankly, no one wants that burden. I mean, why people really have to put themselves out there, I think. And so, you know, we do depend upon our allies from the dominant group. But as a group, you know, it can be a pretty hard sell.
Yeah, no. By the way, I want to thank all the readers. I mean, it was great. I like your. I mean, I don't understand it all, but I like it. It's all in grace. You got to name yourself.
Happy.
That's great. That's the bottom line. Speaking about allies, what is the responsibility of a university such as Michigan State, which is the premier what is the responsibility? And we have great people here to talk about things that teachers that went to the classroom should be aware of, or at least understood, or at least have some idea of what makes this nation a liberal. How can we get that to help us or to help this nation to understand the dynamics of the nation itself in the classroom, because that's where so we have universities such as Michigan State, Central Michigan, and many others that produce teachers. How can we get into those systems and start changing that dynamic so that what they produce is aware that history is not like it's been told 100 years ago. It's evolving, and we're living now with some principles of the past. But it has to evolve. So it is our teaching institutions that has to be one of our partners, one of our support. Not for us only, but for the community of ours.
Okay, so what can MSU be doing to help communities? Now, not to put anyone on the spot, but you're covering a couple of different areas, Chicano Latino studies and education. And not to say that Professor Carter Andrews is speaking for the College of Education, but definitely her perspective from being a professor in the College of Education. Maybe she can respond to that. And Professor Contreras, and you know, anybody else with the education system who may.
Know teachers teach to the meeting. You know if there are any passages, any questions on the meeting that have anything to do with Latino, African American, is there a reading passage that might be taken from, say, Blessing Ultima or something like that, that all kids in the state of Michigan would be touched about?
No, they don't include that, and we have no control over the meeting. By the state of Michigan, and so it's the legislators and the school board head who puts that together. So, but it has to do with where they get all their primary knowledge or expertise is from the universities that produce these folks that then work for the State Department of Education. So, yeah, you're right. You know, it doesn't exist because it's not part of their, you know, frame of thought.
I'm on the university curriculum for the University Committee for Liberal Learning, and we're charged in the process of coming up and developing these rubrics, how we measure certain parts of or aspects of characteristics of the kind of students that people graduate. And high end of the rubric, at the high end of the evaluator, you're talking about a student that's able to identify self, and you're able to talk about, you're talking about a student that's able to enact change, positive change, pretty tall order. I mean, there's a lot of students that go through this, this university in 4 years, and I mean, they really don't have to interact with anybody other than somebody who comes from their own town in some building. So I think that's it's interesting that you said, because we actually are, I start to see like these questions being asked around, like, particularly in this committee. So the discussion is there, and I mean, I kind of see it.
You know, the public school teaching force in our nation is a little over 85% white, middle class people. So when you just think about who's teaching public school children, and that body is becoming increasingly diverse, right? In a matter of years, more than 50% of our nationwide public school population will be students of color, right? But the people who teach them don't reflect the diversity in that demographic. So what I'm always challenging my own college. So similarly, people who teach future teachers are also majority white, middle class women, right? So it mirrors itself. Who themselves have very little self-efficacy in talking about issues of diversity. I'm saying sticking to my content, math, science, social studies, English, reading, whatever. Right? So even in our own College of Ed, where we are number one in the nation for producing teachers, most of my colleagues don't have issues of diversity reflected in their syllabi. Right? And so for me, it's partially about learning about us others, but I feel like what has to happen for future teachers and teacher educators is that they need to examine their whiteness, right? So we're constantly learning about people of color, but whites don't self-reflect on what it means to be white in this country. But most of the students I teach have never thought of themselves as racial beings. They've never thought of themselves as a member of a racial group, where that is my lived experience daily, right? And so how can you go into a classroom and teach other human beings who visibly don't look like you, who have very different lived experiences, if you don't even see yourself as a race to be, and you haven't analyzed really whiteness as normative and racism as white racism? And so I am really pushing, and I have other colleagues who do as well, that we prepare our teachers to engage in that kind of critical self-reflection. Because without that, I don't care how many interactions you have with people of color, if you don't see your people of the majority racial group, they don't begin to examine their own selves as racial beings and what it means to have lived a life of racial privilege. Granted, you might have other kinds of disadvantages, but in our country, if you are white, you have race privilege. And if you don't think about that and examine what that means for how you engage with people who are not white, and your white brothers and sisters, it's a never-ending cycle. And so, I mean, it's funny that you went to East Lansing High. The superintendent of East Lansing hired me 4 years ago to help them solve the achievement gap, right? And I said, you've got a district that's 98% white teachers. Part of your gap is about these white teachers being okay with having race talks. If you can't get people to talk about race, you can't close achievement gaps, right? So, I mean, we've been we've been working through that, and it's just a struggle. You have people who resist. I'm not a racist, but your assessment measures, the way in which you ask questions, the way in which you arrange seats, the way you do discipline referrals. See, without examining what it means to be white in society and
really important connection.
I went to community college. I started at a community college. And I think fucked up on semester. I don't remember. But I did start at a community college. And so I totally understand what you're saying. You know, the message I send to the students we talk to, students in Lansing School District is, you can do it from a community college. I did it from a community college. I do know the statistics, and you're right, but I always want to give them that message of that, it still can be done. Yeah. If you really want an education, you can get it. And I also tell the students sitting around in class complaining, I say, y'all don't understand your privilege, the luxury of being able to read and write. I mean, I know it feels like a burden, but it is like, it's a wonderful life.
Well, the quickest way not to get the bachelor's is to go to the
Well, yeah, statistically, I do not doubt that you're right.
I'd like to add to that. I think for me, it's a matter, it comes down to a matter of life and death. What am I talking about? Some folks will say that the birthplace of cultural competency, training, and education came through the healthcare industry, out of a need of being able to save that life or not. If you were culturally competent enough to understand the culture's dynamics of that patient, then just maybe, you are able to save that life, communicate properly. Not just the black and white science and text and do this and do that. No, no, no. Understanding that there's an additional layer that will allow you to be successful, not only in communicating, but literally saving that life. And to me, our education system is that. Every empire on the planet had a heyday and then was gone. Everybody was number one at some point. The U.S. happens to be number one now. I would hate to be alive when we are no longer number one. But history shows us that will happen. How will it happen faster? If our education system is not meeting the needs of our current demographics and numbers. So to me, it's a matter of life and death of this nation that we have as number one. The death of the nation that number one, ranked number one, will surely come at a faster rate if we are not able to educate the students at the levels we need to be able to get them to the new technology, the new technology economy, the new STEM economy. We're just not there. And if we don't take it seriously, then that is exactly what will happen. There will be other nations that eclipse, and we'll at a faster rate. So to me, it's a matter of life and death, and it's a matter of national security. There's no longer armies of 100,000 people lining up with swords and bayonets and marching. This is a technological warfare, and if we don't get smart about it, it's going to just, while we're all paying attention to something else, Survivor, the newest episode of American Idol or something like that. So to me, it's very serious along those lines. I don't know anything that's more important than that, to be honest with you. So the College of Human Medicine here at MSU has a model that they implement knowing that it is a matter of life and death, where they train the majority of the students that are not students of color. They train them on trying to get them to the level where they are culturally competent enough where they can communicate and effectively save that life. College of Human Medicine.
I just wanted to go back to the Honorable Professor's question about what is it that can be done from MSU and from the College of Ed in particular. I mean, my answer always is to everyone. I think we need it in the Lansing schools, and I think we need it see, the thing is, here at MSU, I mean, departments and programs out there are developing curriculum and methodology studies, and everybody knows that we're getting to be more and more important as a population. But you know what? There is a place on campus that is developing curriculum in Chicano Latino studies, and that's in our office. So one of the challenges, that's in our program, one of the challenges of an institution like this is to get other, because the College of Education has been very insular for a long time, very insular. And the fact is, there's stuff going on in other spaces in campus that could really benefit the students of the College of Ed. So I think those sorts of trans-college and transdisciplinary, so that maybe the College of Ed advisors start saying, hey, there's a Chicano Latino Studies specialization to grad students. There's a graduate certificate, hopefully in the fall, it will be up and running, graduate certificate in Chicano Latino Studies, and to send those students to the places at the university where that knowledge is being developed. I think that, that would be helpful. And I mean, it's not on you.
No, I mean,
I love that idea, right?
But what bothers me.
kind of innovation is risky as a non-tenured person of color. And that's sad to say, but, you know, it's part of the system, and it's sad, you know. So now with my little tenure, I can be like, yeah, you know, because that's what bothers me. The people in those positions of power are not thinking about, in really strategic ways, these kinds of partnerships and innovative ways of branching out.
In the mid-70s, I was a participant of recruitment out of MSU Chicago Latino. I wonder, I'm curious, is that program still in existence?
Well, it has been, to some extent, institutionalized by having Chicanos and Latinos as part of the admissions office. And also, there's a lot of activity with student organizations still. Back then, it was CHISPA, now it's a combination of sorority and fraternity organizations. I think there's a couple of Latino organizations that are involved in recruitment and then, of course, offices like Chicano Latino Studies, Office of Inclusion, are involved for the partner with admissions and these other community or campus organizations to bring students through and to introduce them to MSU. As a matter of fact, right now, someone from Notre Dame contacted me. Okay, so it's not just someone from Notre Dame contacted us about bringing through 60 students. Now, when someone from Notre Dame says MSU is the type of school that I know was around, that's where I would have gone. And this is like the type of community that they want to see their students, the young high school graduates coming into. So I think that in that sense, it speaks a lot to what we are doing as part of the recruitment effort. So yeah, it's been institutionalized, so we have recruitment folks as well as offices, and also that the students are still involved in some form of hosting.
You know, just about every Latino on this campus who's like, you know, we have a lot of people who graduated and they're now staff here at MSU. Just about all of them, a lot of the students I know, all of them can trace their recruitment to MSU to one person, and that's Lucinda Fields. I mean, practically everybody was saying, Lucinda recruited me, Lucinda recruited me. And, you know, there are a couple now, there's they're in the Office of Admissions, they do the Latino Family Day every year. It's like two people. It's a huge university.
But there's also like a large migrant, and there's a migrant program here called the Office of Admissions Migrant Program that brings in, I don't know, maybe 70.
About
70. 70 a year admitted. But from that pool, I think there's maybe like, maybe double that they bring in to introduce them to us, I believe. I may be misquoting the numbers, but I know that it's a larger one. We had their first
effort. Great. I'd like to add to that. I have a fact that I keep when I was in school. Before I got there, they used to call the engineering program that I was in the minority engineering program. When I got there, they could no longer legally call it minority engineering program. So relic, I took it, I keep it still to this day. They have changed the name of it, but it's still MEP. And so they have, because of propositions like Prop 2 here in Michigan, you can have the university be an equal opportunity, equal employment opportunity, employer, affirmative action employer. for your cheer, but not in admissions. And that's the in what's debated, being debated now, with Prop 2 possibly going all the way up to the Supreme Court and rehashing that whole thing. So it's not okay. It's okay to have those type of policies for faculty and or staff, possibly, at least staff. But when you talk about bringing in students and just being and calling under the auspices of minority recruitment along those lines, it's a dangerous area that people are leaving to the courts to decide, and because they called them to say no, this, you can't do that anymore. You know, for the Prop 2 class, I think it was in 2006.
I just wanted to say the College of Ed must be doing something, because I am one of those middle-class white female. I'm actually
we're dumping on you.
Soon to be, no, it's okay. That's why I came. I'm also, different because I'm a post BA going back to my teacher certificate. So I have all these young kids in my class. I have kids. I have high schoolers, and the reason I'm here is because of my TA in one of my classes. And because I am reflecting on my own white privilege, which I never knew even existed until I came back. I graduated from Michigan State the first time in 97, and that was never talked about, And I am also probably different because my education major is agriculture. So, but I am interested in, which we don't have in this area anywhere, urban agriculture. I think that's going to be very important. So I was like, how can I learn more? I'm here for a very short time. And I've seen some of this attitude out of my own kids, which has scared me. My kids will, I said, I was studying the other day, and I said something about white privilege. My son's, what are you talking about? There's no such thing. And I'm like, well, what is it? He couldn't even explain it to me. So I went, oh, I've done my own kids an injustice. So I just, I just wanted to say that the College of Ed is getting through some of us. I don't know if it's an age thing or a maturity thing, because I didn't think about that when I was here, when I was their age. But now that I'm looking back at it and have been in substitute teaching for 6 years in all kinds of school districts, I've been really learning a lot. So I want to thank you guys for having this tonight, and I could actually come.
Well, I just wanted to say something, too, about education. I have to say, I've always loved the education students that I teach in the classes. I do, because you know what? They're really eager. They love kids. They really care. They just don't necessarily have the tools yet.
Right.
So the other day we were reading a story, and I don't remember if you were there, Drew, it was the story, it was describing, it had some information about the father of the story. It was taken from Julia Alvarez's Father Garcia Rios Lost Her Accent. And those things about how the medical office he worked at, we come home, maybe he'd take notes on prescription pads, and how the mom, would take the address labels off the magazines because she heard that drug addicts would look on the magazines in doctor's office, so they had their address and then would rob them, et cetera, et cetera. So there's all this stuff, and I asked her, because, well, what is the father's profession? And people are like, oh, well, he runs a medical office. He's an administrator of a clinic. And there was another part in there where we talked about how the father being in his office and all the sick people there waiting and everything. And I was like, I thought he was a doctor. And everybody's like, no, most of the class, that's like over 40 people, most of the class was like, no. And I was like, God, something's bothering me. Like, what? And thankfully a student said it. She was like, oh, maybe we're just assuming that because this is a Dominican immigrant, it couldn't possibly be a doctor. Because I wanted to ask the question of if it had been a European immigrant, would doctor have popped into our minds as readers much more quickly than, a Spanish-speaking, immigrant from the Dominican Republic. And so that's also where reflexivity can happen, where I think literature has a special, a special power to help people see themselves differently through interrogating or confronting the limits of their own thinking.
This is very interesting. And in April, we're going to a national
seldom do we do. So that's something that I don't know how to fix it. I mean, in education, we thought about why we're having difficulties, and we get great speakers that speak to us. Well, I don't need to hear it. Talk to the governor, you know? Talk to the legislature. That's what needs to hear these messages. But nevertheless, I mean, it's good to reflect. And the other thing I wanted to point out, speaking about things that happened locally, if you remember the Q106 incident.
No.
Okay. That was...
Can you tell
me
about
the Q106 radio station in Lansing. It was... the DJ is still around.
Tim Barron.
Tim Barron. So he played a skit. Came from California.
Not to blame you or anything.
Not to blame you. Just saying they came from
California. California is not bad.
Okay, yeah. But anyway, this was the thing that... win a Mexican for Cinco de Mayo. So you win a Mexican, you call, and then you have a Mexican bring him, you know, across the border in the wheel, well, a tire, whatever, you know, bring him.
And they louse them and
all that stuff. Really, really bad. And so the community came together, which was a good thing about it. I mean, from a diversity, we have many people, and not only Latinos, but non-Latinos. Black and white came with us, and we had a series of hearings. And you get the good and the bad in between all of that. Unfortunately, some of our elected officials were not as supportive as we would like them to be. Nevertheless, it brought the community together. So those kinds of things happen. I still have the recording. Do you have a copy of it in your library?
I have your paper.
The material
that you collected.
So we things have happened in Lansing. And if you go back to 1970 or 71, when there was a walkout in Pennville from the middle schoolers.
We do have those pictures too in the collection.
And that was because and I don't know the whole story to be true, but this is a hearsay. I know is that a faculty person mistreated a Latino. And so the Latinos got to the answer. They walked out in protest. And out of that, the Chicano Advisory Committee to the school board was born.
Wow.
And now the Chicano Latino Advisory Committee, which is something we serve at. Grateful for that. But, I mean, you know, things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think it's our response to whatever happens that's either positive or negative, or mean seeing them. You know? So I think that this is one other hurdle that. And how we're going to respond to that, and what good's going to come out of it. So I think that's what we need to focus on. So it happened. So now what? How do we learn from it, make something positive out of it? One of the things that I think is very important is that we don't, as a community, embrace languages. You know, if you're here, you need to learn English. Well, yeah, that's the language of the world, but it's important to know other languages. Or not to lose yours. You know, and I think that's a community, both in the community neighborhood or in the school community, we embrace that. Not as if only for our survival. We're talking about survival. We have to be more knowledgeable in language than that.
Yeah, my thing is, Drew, what is your original language? Is your original language Espanol? Si?
With
knowledge. See, this is something that I would not have known but for Professor Contreras. And it's something big, and I went online and looked up Ferreira Edmine from California. And because he's a descendant of Aztec, I want him to understand his culture. I just came from Hubbard Hall, so yeah, that's where everything was fun. There was a bunch of kids there. It was great. We had fun ice cream dancing. Stop by on the way to get the car. But this is the thing that but the original language, and this is what... Because of her, and I think this is a movement that I want to see, and it's in its nascent stages, is for more, because he's Mexican, his mother's Mexican, and he's black, teaching about slavery, everything, Aztec, Mayans, black girls, all of it. And I want him to know knowledge, because that is his original language. And this, you guys, I can't find my original language. Black man, slavery, I can't trace it. But you guys have it. You know, I don't know if that's your history. He has his. And it's just, so I just am grateful for her. And I don't think that anybody will ever see it until about 20 years from now, until we hear the descendants of the Aztecs go back. And they say, okay, yes, we do not want the slave language anymore. Spanish, this is not our culture. This is their culture. I am not a Latino because Latin is from the Greek people. This is not Latin. I'm not a Latino. I am indigenous, whatever it is, and this is what I want to do for the most. I just want to put the language part. But we have to learn Spanish, and I try to teach them what I can to be able to convey that to his fellow people so that he will understand, look, yes, I'm Mexican, but this is not my language. This is what is your language? I'm Mexican. That's not what I'm. So this is, I want it to be revolutionary. I think it's important for the betterment of the community.
And I think it's important because there's, I mean, you know, reading literature, and I spent some time, you know, in my office and reading the literature and kind of like reconnecting with some of this literature. I started feeling good again. And I got brought right back on. This was on the way to the Union, from the Union, on my way over here. I was walking with some students. I mean, this happened 6:45. On the way here from the Union, I was walking with one of my students, or three of my students. And there was another group of students with the camera and the list and everything. And she went up to one of my students and says, "Hey, you know, can I get a picture with you?" And he's like, "Okay." She said, "Wait, hold on, what is it?" And I said, "Well, we need a picture with an agent." Said, "Wait, what class is this for?" "Well, it's not a class. It's an organization, they got us to do a scavenger hunt, like an hour to do it.
Oh my God.
And I told him, I said, "No, you can't take this picture. I'm sorry." They looked at me, they were shocked, but they didn't know why. And if I didn't have this to come, I would have spent half an hour. I'd probably still be out there trying to get some money. But, you know, we have a phrase in the jazz studies department, each one teach one. It was a slap in the face.
Well, I hope that this is, I mean, that's really a really good message to carry with us from this about Hope Fanny.